This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. When you think about going to the public library, maybe you imagine checking out books or attending a poetry reading or craft night for the family. But there is more to the library these days with a program aimed at bringing in social workers. With us now is Darian Benson, a reporter with Side Effects Public Media, who recently had a feature on this topic. Welcome to the program, Darian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What did you learn about this, and when did you learn about this collaboration where social workers are working in public libraries?
Yeah, so I actually learned about the Indianapolis Public Library, the Central Branch, which is in downtown Indianapolis, hiring their first social worker a few months ago. Our community engagement specialists with Side Effects and WFYI were actually working on a different project with the public library, and you know, the director just offhandedly mentioned that they hired their first social worker. They relayed that to me, and I was like, this is really interesting. I, you know, set up some calls with them, and I wanted to learn more about this position because she just started in July. It's fairly new, and she's one of the only social workers in Indiana that's based out of the public library.
Wow, that's a pretty huge milestone. And you spoke with Yana McGraw, who's the social worker. Can you tell us about her role at the Indianapolis Public Library?
Yeah, so like I said, she just started in July this past summer. So she's kind of still developing what her role as the social worker is at her branch. But she can do things that, you know, a librarian isn't trained to do. You know, people often come to the library because it's the only place they can go. To, you know, they feel safe there. They might be able to ask questions, and librarians are trained, you know, answer a wide variety of questions, but they're not really able to dig into some of the more tough situations that people might be facing, like those who experience homelessness or severe mental illness, things like that. So as a social worker, Yana can, you know, take the time to really work with patrons who come to her who are seeking for help. She can make calls to service providers, can help people get into some shelters, and just a wide variety of things. She can really, like I said, take that time to really work one-on-one and develop these relationships with patrons when a librarian, you know, might have a million other things to do or isn't really trained in that specific expertise.
It's really interesting that this wasn't thought of before because it just sounds like such a great initiative to put forward. And her story is so inspirational in the way that when I was reading your piece about the way she handles her job and really does have an open door policy. What do you think we can learn from her?
Yeah, she said, you know, something that's really important in social work is developing relationships. So she does have an office in the library itself, but she spends a lot of her time, you know, walking around the library, talking to different people. If you've been to the Central Library in downtown Indianapolis, it's huge. It's a couple stories tall. So she just, you know, wanders around talking to people, letting people come to her. And I think that's something that she talked a lot about is, you know, she's working with members of our community, and it's members that are part of all of our communities. And it's really important that we take the time to work with and learn from our community members to make sure that they're doing okay so that we're all doing okay.
If you have any questions or comments for our show today, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Side Effects Public Media's Darian Benson about a recent feature she did on social workers working in public libraries. Darian, what did you learn while uncovering this story?
You know, I learned quite a bit. I learned that this is an initiative, you know, having social workers in public libraries that kind of started picking up steam in the past couple of years. I spoke with Melanie Huggins, who's the president of the Public Library Association. She said in the past 10 years, they've seen an increase in public libraries who are wanting to do some sort of social work collaboration. I believe the first public library who had a social worker hired by them was in California. And since then, librarians have been like, oh yeah, this is definitely something that not only that we should do, but that we could do. There's just a wide variety of needs that the community members seek help with. And public libraries are often the place that many people turn to. I also learned that it's not as easy as just simply hiring a social worker. There's a few different barriers. that come to hiring. Of course, budget in a public library, and just finding a social worker who can really assist the needs that the library is faced with.
Yeah, speaking of budget, is this something that the library, they pay for the social worker to come in, or is this an outside organization that works with them?
Yeah, in Indianapolis, Yana's position is actually funded through their budget. The Central Branch Library had a librarian who retired. So in the next year, they were able to kind of modify the money that was going to be allocated to that position into a social work position.
I know you mentioned earlier that you sort of learned about this program through a coworker, but did you know anything about these types of programs before you heard about it?
Yeah, not necessarily social work, but I know that public libraries across the country, and especially in Indiana, have been doing a lot of public health services or, you know, public health programs in past years, especially this past year with the, or the past 2 years, I should say, the COVID-19 pandemic. There have been vaccine clinics that have popped up that are hosted in public libraries. In Indiana, librarians across the state have been assisting in actually registering people for the COVID-19 vaccine. There, you know, librarians have often helped with open enrollment for health insurance. A lot of libraries are stocking Narcan in case there's an opioid overdose, which is actually common in public libraries. Because like I said before, libraries are one of the only places that people can kind of come in and chill out all day. They don't have to spend any money. So a lot of patrons that might be experiencing substance use disorder or homelessness. So libraries across the country are starting to get trained on how to administer Narcan and kind of also assist in, you know, substance use disorder resources and mental health resources to kind of help those patrons out.
So it sounds like there's a lot of public health initiatives happening at libraries.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's why social work is so important, and to have some sort of social worker inside of a library, because like I mentioned before, librarians really aren't trained to do this more in-depth relationship building and resource connecting that social workers are trained to do.
Yeah. And it also sounds like it makes sense to do a program like that, because just putting a lot of pressure on librarians to be any and everything to the patrons and actually get some help is a good idea. Has this been going on for a while in terms of not just public health initiatives, but the social workers in libraries, or is this a very new, I know you mentioned in Indiana since the summer, but I'm just curious on a broader scale.
Yeah. I spoke with the Public Library Association, and they said that started kind of picking up steam in the past 10 years. A library in San Francisco, I believe, actually hired a social worker. And since then, more libraries have started finding different ways to incorporate social workers. Maybe that might look like what Indianapolis did and hired an actual social worker, or working with outside organizations or having part-time social workers inside their libraries.
Do you think enough people know there are options like this available? I don't know if you're able to speak to anyone and see what their thoughts were about having resources like this around.
Yeah, I spoke with Yana, and she said, I spoke with Yana, and she said sometimes people, especially with her position, it's so new that a lot of people didn't know that they had a social worker. So when they find out that the library does have one, they're shocked, but it's very welcomed. Her goal in this next year is to really put herself out there so more people know that she is available for them, and that there are other programs and resources at the library available to people who might need them.
What did you hear from other folks you spoke with about the benefits of a program like this?
Yeah, I spoke with a researcher who actually conducts studies across the country at different public libraries to kind of do a needs-based assessment to see how they might benefit from a social worker. And she said she sees a lot of the same situations and problems in other libraries across the country, a big increase in people who might need mental health services or helping find some sort of shelter or food insecurity, domestic abuse resources. across the country, and she said there's kind of a growing need for them in the past couple of years, and social workers can really help those people out and really, you know, like you mentioned before, alleviate this bandwidth problem that librarians face and trying to help out patrons.
Where does Indiana stand with programs like this? Are they leading the way? Are they following other states that have already done this?
I spoke with the Public Library Association, and they said that Indiana is one of the first states, not necessarily the first state, but one of the first states to have a social worker and have programs like this in the country. So it's a growing trend, definitely. And Indiana is pretty much on the forefront.
That's really cool to hear that Indiana's leading the way in some of these types of initiatives. Are there any other states or programs that have been doing this for a while, or certain programs like this that we should be emulating, or that you think Indiana is on the path to sort of following their footsteps?
Yeah, I spoke with a librarian at a library in South Carolina, and they actually have 10 social workers.
Wow.
In their library system. Yeah. So I think that's really cool. She said that some of them had like specific jobs. So one social worker might just be working with housing insecurity, or another might be working with, you know, homelessness. They kind of have more specific work that they help patrons with. And, you know, something I talked to Yana at the Indianapolis Library about is there's only one her. Technically, she's at the central branch, just one branch in the Indianapolis Public Library system. But she really does work with, you know, every single library in the system. And it's a pretty large system. So I think, you know, just having more resources and more social workers to be able to assist in these needs would be really beneficial.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Darian Benson is a reporter with Side Effects Public Media and recently had a feature on this topic. We will be back after a quick break. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're discussing social work today and the different aspects of social work. Oftentimes, we may think of it as one thing, but it can be used in various settings. With us now to learn the ins and outs of social work and how it applies to our daily lives is Pat Sullivan, Associate Dean, School of Social Work at Indiana University, Bloomington. Welcome, Pat.
Thank you very much for having me, Miriam. Glad to be on.
Well, let's start with the role of social work in society. What is the role of social work?
That's a really good question. Social work is a really, really broad field and really has been almost from its inception, from working with individuals and families to working along big systems, nonprofit management, nonprofit organizations, and in business and organizations. So it's a very, very big and diverse field, which makes it pretty hard to pin down.
What would you say are the most common types of work that folks who study social work go into?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think certainly what we refer to now as behavioral health, mental health and addictions is certainly one of the top places in which social workers find work, and in healthcare in general. Obviously, social work has long been associated with work with children and families, and that has certainly been something that's been pretty strong throughout. But I would think that probably overall it would be in the area of mental health and addictions.
I would say probably the first impression I had when I was a young child wasn't that long ago. Okay. right. When I used to hear the term social work or you'd hear things like caseworkers, I always thought it was something to do with child services and it was something scary that you just did not want to be a part of. Are these common misconceptions?
Very common misconceptions. Obviously, we have a strong presence in that. In fact, the IU School of Social Work does a lot in terms of training people who are going to take positions, not just people who are graduates of our program, but even those who are in the system who deal with problems that children and families face. I mean, there is just simply no escaping the fact that we have situations where we have an obligation, particularly to look out for vulnerable children. We do have an obligation also to do what we can to keep families intact for the benefit of all. And we've certainly been involved in that field for a long time. But that is a certain stigma we have. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And the notion that social workers come in and the number one job is to snatch children away from their families capriciously. Obviously, we fought that one for a while, but we've had a strong presence in that field, and your own perception probably matches most people's.
And how do you combat that kind of misinformation or stigma that's out there?
It's a really good question, isn't it? I mean, I think we try to speak about the good work we do and what our values are as a profession. Our values are very much rooted in self-determination and in the preservation of families. I'm one of the founders of a model called the Strengths Model that suggests that we really benefit greatly when we also focus on the strengths and abilities that people have and making sure they have the opportunities to develop as maximally as they can. You know, we've worked very hard in many ways to demonstrate that we are a diverse field, as your previous segment just pointed out. But it's been an uphill battle. There's just simply no way to deny that.
Yeah, and especially I wonder, with all the conversations now about equity and access, if that has played a role at all in social work.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're very, very much interested in that. You know, everything from adverse childhood experiences to, you know, issues of equal access to care, to access to quality care, health inequities. That's a big focus on social work and social work education. I mean, I was part of a group that was convened by the Council of Social Work Education a few years ago in Denver to look at health equity and things of that nature. And we're certainly concerned about that, as everybody should be concerned, because when we have a system in which people do not have access to quality care on a variety of fronts, or once there receive less than optimum care, we all pay for that one way or another. We pay for it not only in poor outcomes, we pay for it in dollars and cents. And that's a concern, I would think, for all Americans.
One thing that I hear a lot discussed in mental health, and I'm going to assume in social work as well, is cultural competency. And yeah. I'm curious how much that has changed, let's say, in the last 10 years, because I don't know that there were discussions like this enough before.
It's a dramatic thing. In fact, I was just in a meeting this morning about that very thing, and it's really forced us to look at everything that we do, even educationally, to take a look at our classes, even simple things, Miriam. Like, for example, I mean, in research classes, I mean, chi-square analysis is chi-square analysis. But if your examples are always skewed, that you don't allow for an understanding of how this fits in certain contexts, even an understanding of medication, responding differently, or individuals responding differently, is something that becomes important. It has been a big part of social work for a while. To say that it has ramped up greatly recently would be absolutely true. You know, we're in the process of hiring an associate dean for diversity to just take a look at all of our processes, everything from how we recruit students, what happens to students when we get them, how do we retain them? How do we create opportunities for them? What do our course materials look like? What's the content of our courses? What's the climate? How can we do our part to continue to, you know, create a more just world is very central to social work and social work education.
You mentioned retaining students and keeping track of maybe the career paths that they're choosing afterwards. So some people may think of social workers as those who've gone down a path that is stressful and not very financially rewarding. Is there anything that's being done to change that? Or like when you're tracking students who've graduated, are they staying in the field?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting thing. I mean, obviously, for some, they're going to get into it and find out that it's something that they once thought they wanted to do, and they learn that they don't. There's no question it can be a stressful field. There's a lot of stressful fields out there, I might add, and we're one of them. I think we have seen a little bit of movement in terms of the elevation of the status and the salaries in some circumstances. But there's another thing that I often tell our students, and I think it's probably true, no matter what line of work, profession, vocation someone walks down, which is if you wish to be great and you wish to try to exceed and excel as an individual, there are opportunities for you in social work where you can make an awfully good living. I mean, the vast majority nationwide, for example, of our community mental health center directors are directors who have a social work degree. Now, are they at the very top end of the income scale? They're not. But are they living comfortable lives? They are. And the one thing that I would say is, and it's something that I feel a lot is, if it's something that is meaningful to you to do, that if at some point in your life you're able to look in the mirror and say, did I make a difference in the world? Did I make a difference in other people's lives? Did I help turn the life around for a child or a family or a person who had a mental illness? That's a pretty good thing to be able to look in the mirror and give an affirmative answer. And we are a value-driven profession, and obviously those who feel an affinity with those values and they're important to them and they're central to their lives are those who are probably going to be more resilient with the ups and downs and slings and arrows that come as a form of public service.
I think also in fields like this, knowing that you've changed somebody's life, you probably can't even put a price on that. It's so much more rewarding.
No, it can. And it's really funny. It's like, I've been a practitioner. I was the state director of mental health for a number of years. I've done a lot of different things. And I've been a college professor for 33 years. And it's very interesting that some of the moments that I've had as a college professor that I most remember are a student who came in and I really didn't think perhaps they were going to be able to make it, go ahead and get that degree. Perhaps they'd been given some bad advice somewhere along the way and their transcript was a mess. And to be able to sit down with them and see that moment when they walked across that stage and shook the dean's hand and took a diploma and looked out at their families, that's the reason for being if you're a college professor. And those are the moments that really drive you.
If you're listening and you have any questions or comments for our guest today, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Pat Sullivan, Associate Dean, School of Social Work at Indiana University Bloomington, about social work's role in society, among other things. Pat, I want to talk a little bit about social workers in schools. Not all schools have social workers, and then there are those who do have social workers in roles where maybe they're just programming things like social-emotional learning tips. Is that enough for schools, or should they have more counseling-like services available?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think it's very helpful, personally. And you hit on something that is absolutely true, which is I think we've learned over time that the role that social workers play in a school is very much predicated on the particular culture of that school. I have a personal example. I worked in a community mental health center in rural Kansas, and the home office of our mental health center was about 9 miles apart between two other Kansas towns. One of the towns that we would sometimes visit, it was very clear that the principal wanted us in and out of there as fast as we absolutely could. I mean, they wanted, to be honest with you, no part of us. Whereas just up the road, the other school called upon us all the time to do workshops, to meet with students, to talk about issues that might be on the student's mind at that particular time. You know, it's an interesting thing. We have made, and I think rightfully so, great strides to do everything we can to keep children in a school setting. I'm so old that when I was a young man, I can remember. I have a vivid memory of a young woman I was in school with in the third grade that clearly had problems, a variety of problems, and then one day she was gone, never to be seen again. And, you know, we have worked increasingly hard to try to create situations where students like that can succeed. And our teachers have a lot to do in the classroom anyway. They also are great observers of things that are happening with the students in their classroom. They detect early on that there are problems or issues, or they may ask the question, why is this student failing to thrive? And they've got plenty on their plate. And the fact that sometimes we can call a social worker in to perhaps dig around a little bit, get to the bottom of some interesting situations. I'll give you a perfect case example of this is about as simplistic as you can get. But I worked with the program as a consultant in Indianapolis for a number of years that did sort of innovative things with children who might ordinarily end up in a residential setting or perhaps be placed out of state. And we were dealing with a situation where a kid was just routinely truant from school that looked just like a straight behavioral problem. And a team got in there and quite frankly found out that one of the big issues is that the family was poor, didn't have a washer and a dryer. The kid was constantly forced to wear dirty clothes to school, for which they got ridiculed and made fun of. And the easy thing for them to do was to simply not go, ditch school on the way there. And we discovered that if we could just get them a washer and a dryer and the kid had clean clothes, guess what? They'd stay in school and have an opportunity to move forward in their education. That's something a social worker can assess and look at and see and feel, and also perhaps uncover that a child is dealing with depression or anxiety. We often think that childhood is a fun time. It's not a fun time for all children. Lots of children deal with those real world problems and issues. Or perhaps there's trouble in the home. Perhaps there's abuse there. And this is one of the first lines of defense, if you will, or opportunity to see those things. And that's why I think social workers in schools could be incredibly beneficial.
Thank you so much for sharing those stories. And I'm just reflecting on the child who didn't want to come to school because they're being ridiculed. I mean, that's just heartbreaking, but it's also heartwarming to know that there is a solution.
Yeah, I mean, just to take it one step forward, we had another situation in that particular setting where we had the same problem with the student, but we found out that this student was just not far enough away to ride the bus, and so walked to school. It was frankly getting shook down and threatened by a group of older kids on the way to the class. Again, a not particularly wealthy family. And just to remind you, counties spend inordinate amounts of money dealing with children and children issues, whether it is that they place them in some sort of residential center. For many years, there was a program we used a lot out of state. I remember this when I was a state director of mental health, and it cost counties and cost taxpayers thousands of dollars, right? And the kid is suffering. The solution in this particular case, be honest with you, was to get the kid a bicycle. Now, you get the child a $150 bike or a $100 bike, and they're able to take the bike and rock it around the people who are causing him trouble and go to school and get that done. Not only do we have a great outcome, it's an outcome that makes a great deal of fiscal sense. So sometimes you just have to think out of the box to think about how we can attack these issues.
And that's something I was just going to ask you. How do you encourage folks to think outside the box? Because I think sometimes when you have like a routine and day-to-day of how things are done, you don't often try to think of other ways to solve things.
Well, it's really problematic because, you know, even community mental health centers and other providers get in the same box, and in part because they also have to survive. So they are going to do largely a service that is reimbursable. That's what they have to do to survive. So it has to perhaps be an approved treatment or something that an outside vendor who pays for such services understands clearly is something that has been proven to be a little beneficial. But when you put the individual or the family in the center, and you begin to sort of think to yourself, seriously, what is it that this individual needs to be successful? If I could do anything I wanted to do, what is it that I could put together and make this work? This is why fiscal policy shapes behavior and why it's absolutely important. For example, I don't think there's anybody who disagrees that regular exercise makes a difference in people's lives. Not only just in healthcare, basic healthcare benefits, weight control, you know, those sort of things, but there's a fair amount of evidence that it also helps with one's emotional well-being, right? I mean, we tend to know that. And yet, rarely do you have the prescription be, let's let this individual, let's develop a plan of exercise. It's a lot easier to say, let's give them a medication.
Right, right. Well, we'll continue this conversation after a quick break. We're talking about social work and how it's evolving to meet the needs of communities. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're speaking about social work today and where it appears to be headed. With us is Pat Sullivan, Associate Dean, School of Social Work at Indiana University, Bloomington. Pat, I do want to talk a little bit about the collaboration at IU Bloomington. Can you tell us about it and what's going on exactly there?
Well, it's really an exciting time at Bloomington. Now, first of all, as some of your listeners may know, that our School of Social Work is 110 years old. It is the largest, oldest public School of Social Work in the country, and for the beginning of its existence, it's been based in Indianapolis, and that is still the case. The main program is at on IUPUI's campus. We've been in Bloomington for a number of years, and until recently, the social work program was housed in two very nice little old houses on Atwater Street, and we recently moved in with a variety of other health sciences into the new Regional Academic Health Center on the bypass on the north end of Bloomington, where we're housed with other like health sciences disciplines. And for us, this is a really, really great new day because I think the most basic thing to say is it's so often we've addressed some of the problems and issues that we have. Let's just use healthcare as an example, in a very reductionist and piecemeal fashion. While an individual may have suffered from a heart attack, there's all sorts of other things that go into play when that individual has a heart attack. What's their emotional state? Are there any alterations in their lifestyle that need to occur? An older adult has a stroke. Do we need to really think about how their house is set up? Is this house still the right sort of environment for them to thrive? This has allowed us or allowing us to do. For example, we have a simulation center in that new building where people like social workers and people in medical schools and nurses can actually simulate a case example and to be able to see firsthand how the different disciplines view that situation from their particular lens, the ability then to learn a little bit differently because other disciplines are looking through a slightly different lens, and then to be able to think even the next level up and creatively about what is the best plan of action for us to proceed with this given individual. So this has just been marvelous. We have a health sciences council, which meets today. Things like the speech and hearing clinic that are there. The speech and hearing clinic can benefit from social workers working with those children and families and adults. I mean, it works hand in glove. You don't think about this often, but good dental hygiene. First of all, we know that dental hygiene is implicated in a whole wide range of healthcare outcomes, number one. Number two, I've spent most of my career working with people, adults in particular, with serious and persistent mental illnesses, where they have, frankly, often atrocious dental care and follow-up. You know, can we partner together to provide good holistic services for people who come in one door, but frankly, they need a team to bear on them to be able to really develop a kind of a rounded care package to enhance their life? So this is a real opportunity for us to really work together and to do some creative things, to do some creative research. And we just opened up, for the first time this year, IU Hospital moved in the location there on the 5th of December. It's really a very exciting time. It's a really exciting time for social work.
It sounds really cool. I mean, I'm just thinking about all these programs, and maybe cool is not the right word. It's really impressive just to see how, like you mentioned, working with the dental health field or other things I never would have thought about, to be honest. I feel like it gives a more well-rounded care, as you mentioned, but a community feeling where it's not just you by yourself, but there's some other folks there that can help you along the way.
That's right. I mean, and obviously when you're stuck, I mean, if you think about it, you know, the problems that we face are complex, and complex problems don't lend themselves to simple solutions. None do. Let's just talk about your first segment. You know, Dr. Beth Waller, who was the associate dean at the School of Social Work at IUPUI, she's now the director of the program at University of North Carolina at Charlotte. She was a main driver of that library program. Think about the power of that particular program, particularly as we try to extend our reach beyond our urban areas into rural settings, a place where people may congregate, where they have broadband internet that works, where they may come looking for some ideas for problems that they face. What are the potentialities now as we're working more and more in a telehealth environment? You know, one of the great, if you will, if there's been a silver lining to the COVID situation is we've really expanded our use of telehealth. And quite frankly, we have found that it is pretty effective with some people. That has the potential to extend our reach. So could we have teams of people who work? If we have rural elderly, for example, who are isolated and alone, who have health care needs, behavioral health care needs, they need help getting basic needs met, food, they're having trouble with the utilities. To have a team of individuals from different disciplines who can work in that arena, perhaps reducing the burden of travel, the expense of travel, all the things that might be in the way, physical impediments. Could we start developing some interesting, if you will, interventions that really does extend our reach, and to do so with partners from other disciplines? I mean, this is really the cusp of a new time.
Absolutely. And I think that just with the technology and you know, for folks who are able to have access to that technology, telehealth is just like a game changer. I'm just thinking of for myself, like there's nothing I dread more than making appointments and then trying to find parking and get to the place and then wait. And then like my anxiety is building up and I'm like, well, you know, especially the dentist, like, am I going to have a cavity? So just being able to like do it from the comfort of my home where I'm in my element, there's nothing like it.
You know, the funny thing is my wife works in behavioral health. She works for Community Mental Health Center in Indianapolis. And at the beginning of the shutdown, they were fairly convinced that, you know, this was going to be a real problem fiscally. And she was told that she was going to be furloughed for about, I think, 25% of her time. That lasted for about a week and a half because they discovered very quickly that actually their no-show rate went down. Their productivity went up, and all of that happened in a telehealth environment. Now, telehealth does not work for all people, but it works for a significant number of people. So it's going to be really important for us to understand who does it work for, who doesn't work for, what are the outcomes of that, and what are the differences of that. But you're absolutely right. If you are in a rural setting, the number one barrier to sequence services is like, literally this old phrase, miles to and then miles on the highway. In other words, how long it takes you to get to a major thoroughfare, then how long does it take you to get to your destination? If you were someone that at the moment is starting to feel like you might have a significant problem with addictions, for example, or you're depressed or anxious, or you're worried about your child, sometimes it's at the crisis, but you know the root of the word crisis means fork in the road. And that's really what it is. And that's a point where you're the most vulnerable to do something and to change. If you have an immediacy that may come with an ability to use a telehealth platform, you know, the chance may be now that you will get the help you need. If you delay and you feel over and you tell yourself, well, maybe it's not that bad, then that chance, that moment, potentially of change has just gone away. So these are some of the benefits we've seen. The folks at the Mental Health Center in Bloomington also told me that one of the unique things about the service was where before, if you were in Bloomington and you presented at the Bloomington office and you wanted to seek services, you were often waiting to see if a Bloomington clinician was available. Now, the triage is anybody within their entire system that you may be able to hook up with telehealth. So the access, you know, in some level has improved. Now, the demand is still high, and it's still hard to get right in. But we see some really interesting developments in this arena.
With the demand, do you think a part of that is the stigma around getting help has diminished a little bit, and now more people are demanding care?
Isn't that interesting? Because, as some of you may know, Dr. Bernice Pesca-Solito at IU of Bloomington is a internationally known researcher, and she's done such stellar work for so many years. Bernice and I go back over a quarter century. And recently, with help United, the Indianapolis Colts, who have made mental health stigma really one of their sort of social causes, she has some additional money in her center to be able to combat mental health stigma. But it is absolutely true, as we have reduced stigma, which is good, and we've made people understand or helped people understand that these conditions and feelings they have are not unusual and do require some attention, yes, that means demand will by definition increase. And that does put a lot of pressure on the system.
Do you think more people are not as willing to be unhappy as in the past, when maybe the message was just to grin and bear it?
You know, I think that's actually right. That's something we probably don't have a lot of academic conversations about, but should. For example, one of the things that Indiana had a cadre of community mental health leaders who had been around almost from the very beginning, and they were around for a long time. And a few years ago, many of them started to retire, and they could talk very specifically about the workforce, for example. The workforce suddenly is prioritizing things about their own well-being. Their gym time has become very important. No, they weren't willing, you know, to continually work overtime after overtime after overtime to either get ahead or make that extra dollar. That they have sort of reconsidered or rethought how they wanted to live their life. And I think that's a really good point, actually. I think people, and sometimes perhaps we're too grandiose about what life should offer us, but I do think that we're not as willing to accept situations of unhappiness or accept that life is routine and humdrum, that we may want more. And as a result, that's got people a little bit more introspective.
We talk a lot on our show about things like social media and how it's impacted many different things in our lives and in society. And one thing I noticed a few years ago was this uptick in folks talking about mental health or providing tips online, creating followings, putting quotes and affirmations. Does that water down actually doing the work and getting help? I guess because I wonder if these things that folks are posting online and think are helpful could actually be harmful.
I can't give you a definitive answer. I mean, social media is the most interesting creature of all time. I think about this all the time. When I was in junior high school, a thing developed that was called a slam book.
And oh, yes.
people would have a spiral notebook. They put your name at the top, and people make comments about you. And it could be devastating. I can't imagine what it's like to be a young person in the social media world. I really can't. I have a side gig and have for years. I'm a racing announcer. I announce a lot of auto races, not only in Indiana, but across the country. I have people on social media that critique my every word. That did not happen when I began my career over 30 years ago. I don't know if I could have taken it if I would have done this at the beginning of my career. So do those affirmations help? I do think that you can have a virtual community of support in a way that we did not have before. People can reach out to you in ways that they never did before. But I do think there are times when there is a great deal of effort to just provide the comfort and to minimize the feelings that someone has, when it's probably true that the feelings that someone has are acute and serious enough that they probably need to go in and have a pretty good conversation with someone about exactly what's going on with their life.
Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, what do you hope to see in your field as we look to the future?
More interdisciplinary work. I mean, I'm really, really excited about that. I'm really excited about the opportunity to work with other colleagues and to develop systems, I think, that put people at center stage and begins to think about what it will take to help individuals, you know, develop, to live healthy and happy lives, and what can we do collectively to do that. You know, we have, for example, and I was the head of it, I'm not saying this to be negative, we have a division of mental health and addictions. What it really is a division of mental illness and addictions, because we focus so directly on the problems and the problems that people have. Sometimes our social policies need to be turned around and not be there to address problems, but to address what does it take? What are the common needs? What are the common needs that people need? What do people need to be as vibrant and as productive as they can be, and what supports can we put around them to do that? We do have to attack problems. There's no question about that serious. But I just do think the synergy that can come with a bunch of disciplines working together and try to attack some of these complex issues is going to be one of the most exciting developments over the next 25 years.
And I wonder, too, if that kind of approach would also ease up the stigma from folks who may have tried to get help and there was no cultural competency, and so it just left them thinking that it's not for them.
That's just a fantastic point, you know. And do they have avenues to receive that care? Very early in my career, I assembled a group of ministers and members of the clergy on the west side of Indianapolis, as we had an influx of individuals from other countries, Mexico, you know, Latin America, et cetera, because it dawned on me that the first point of contact for people in difficulty would be those individuals. And how could we work with them to be, if you will, the gateway, first of all, and then to try to get our systems to respond more culturally sensitive and more proactively to make sure those individuals were not denied the help they need or simply didn't try to seek them because they didn't feel they'd be welcomed. We've got a lot of work still to do in that area.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Pat Sullivan, Associate Dean, School of Social Work at Indiana University, Bloomington. It's been a pleasure to have you on today.
It's been fantastic. Thanks for the conversation.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.